Without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Dave D. from Fresno, California.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Dave.
Hi.
My, you sure look nice. It's amazing what happens and how well you clean up, you know. It just is wonderful. It's terrific to be here. Just for my own information, and for no reason at all other than that, how many people are there present here who are newcomers, that is to say, in the first 30 days of sobriety? Would you hold your hand up just so I can get an idea? Some over there, some over there, some over there. Isn't that terrific? You know, if alcohol is any part of your problem, you're in the right place. This is your home. And if you have any doubt about that, just ask yourself, when was the last time you were applauded for being a drunk? Think about it, you know. But it's good to be here. It's really good to be here. You know, I couldn't help but, as I sat up here at the table, thinking, God, they've got us even segregated over here, you know. Did you notice that? The California folks are on this side and the Oregonians over here. Not only that, but you know, I admire you folks for your tremendous attitude about segregation. Here you had JoJo, this lovely brown lady over here, you know. You thought I was going to say black, didn't you? Huh? I speak to you last night, and that's something, you know, a black lady in AA. And then just to show how integrated you really were, you had a male Al-Anon talk to you this afternoon. Weird, you know. And tonight you got a Mexican priest handling the whole deal. You can segregate us over here if you want, and we're going to keep coming back, I'll tell you, you know. This is our kind of place. I really like it here. I just have fallen in love with Oregon. I'm told that I may come visit, but I may not stay. And I'll settle for that right now. You know, that's kind of nice. And it is good to be here. As you'll see, I tug at my pants a lot. You wonder why. They're not going to fall down. There's too much there to hold them up. But I do this, and I get just as nervous as all get out whenever I stand in front of one of these microphones. And it used to be I couldn't figure out why. And, you know, because I make my living talking to people, right? And they don't make me nervous over there. And I finally figured out what the difference was. You see, over there, when I talk to them, I'm always telling them what they should be doing, right? And over here, you want me to talk to you about myself. And worse than that, you want me to be honest about it, you know. And that becomes very difficult. But I'll try. With your permission, and even without it, I'll try to tell you what it was like and what happened and what I'm trying to be like now. I want to assure you that I'm not at all sure that it's the truth that I'm going to tell you. It's my version of it, though, and I'm stuck with it, you know. It is what I remember. Now, it well could be that it's different, but I don't know. But anyway, that's what I'm going to try to do. And to begin at the beginning, I was born and raised in a little town in New Mexico, a place called Gallup, New Mexico. And just to show you how far back my insanity goes, I liked it there. I thought it was just a lovely place. You see, my people have been in what is now the state of New Mexico for 300 years. They've just always been there, you know. We even beat some of the Indians in there. But we've just always been there, and it was just great. And, you know, we people who speak Spanish have a way of showing our regard for those among us, if we have any respect and regard for them. We had a prefix to their name, D-O-N, you know. And one grandfather in this area was Don Teofilo. And God, that was nice, you know. And the other grandfather was Don David. And my father was Don Miguel. And I just knew that when I grew up, it was going to be the same way with me, right? Didn't work out that way, but that was the plan, you know. And what happened instead is this. As you'll remember, Great Depression came on the land, and my father, like so many others, his business went belly up, and he had to move somewhere else. Well, now, living in Gallup, New Mexico, on Highway 66, we'd watched every Okie in the world head out to California, you know. Oh, you don't have to be so smug. You're out there, you know. So we figured the Okies knew something, and so we just hopped on the tail end of the parade and followed them out to California, and we wound up in California. We wound up in a part of California, in Los Angeles, as a matter of fact. It was a part of Los Angeles that since has become very famous. A place called Watts. Incidentally, we didn't make it famous. The other guys did, you know. But I grew up in Watts. And, you know, I want to tell you something. If you've ever lived in Watts, you have an ambition in common with everybody else that's ever lived in Watts. You know what that is? Get the hell out of Watts. Yeah, that's it, you know. And I did, boy. I had that ambition. I just knew that I had to get out of Watts. Everything there was less than, you know. And the people that were there had jobs that paid less than anybody else's jobs. They had less jobs than anybody else, too, you know. And everything was less than. And I figured out very, very quickly that the trick was to get out of Watts. And I figured that my vehicle for getting out of Watts was going to be education. That's what I figured. And I didn't know how I was going to get one of those things, but by God, I was going to go to college somehow. Well, what happened in my case had nothing to do with me. World War came along, and I went into the Navy, and I came out of the Navy, and Uncle Sam said, here's a GI Bill of Rights. And with that, I determined that by God, I was going to get an education, and I did, because I was going to be somebody. You see, the whole thing of my life has always been to become somebody, to become somebody. And I figured the way to become somebody and to show you people that I was somebody was to get smart. Well, there were those who, well, I won't tell you what they called me, but anyway, I thought that's what I'd do is to just do that. And with this new GI Bill of Rights that they had enacted, I went to the university and I decided to study accounting. I guess I chose well. Because by the time I was a senior at that university, I took and passed the examination as a certified public accountant in the state of California, and by God, I knew I had it made. I knew it, because I became one of seven. Well, today you call a Spanish surname, but in those days we were just Mexicans, you know. And I became one of seven Mexican CPAs in the state of California, by God. And you were going to have to pay attention to me, because I now had begun my way on becoming somebody. I had done it. And I went down to this place, looked for a job, and I found a job with an accounting firm in downtown Los Angeles. And I went to work for this guy who taught me very many things. Tremendous guy. Tremendous guy. Well, this is the guy that taught me, it's kind of a neat thing to learn on your first job. This guy taught me the magic of the martini lunch, you know. I hadn't been on the job 2 weeks, and the boss says, let's go out. And I said, where are we going? He says, lunch. And I learned very quickly that if you left at 11 with him and came back at 2 or 3 with him, you're never going to get in trouble. And I learned how to do that real quickly. It didn't take very long. And one day, I'd moved out of Watts by now. I'd moved up to a place called South Pasadena. It impresses you, huh? It turns out that I integrated South Pasadena, you know. That wasn't the plan. That's just the way it worked out. And one day, I was going home. And Sandy says to me, where are you headed, Dave? And I says, home. He says, at 5 o'clock, rush hour? And I says, well, yeah. He says, why don't you wait out the traffic? I says, where would you do that, Sandy? He says, the Biltmore Bar seems like a likely place. And so I learned how to wait out traffic at the Biltmore Bar. Now, mind, this is, 30 years ago. And I have no idea what the traffic is like between downtown Los Angeles and South Pasadena today. There were 10 miles of freeway. But would you believe me if I told you that in those years it wouldn't let up until 9:30 or 10 at night? Anyway, I learned how to wait out the traffic. And it wouldn't do for me to tell you that this guy was an alcoholic, right? That would be for Sandy to say, wouldn't it? But I have a sponsor, you know, and my sponsor says, well, you know, Dave, if it looks like a duck, and if it quacks like a duck, and if it walks like a duck, it's probably a duck. I have half an idea Sandy was a duck, you know. Because he had lost his family behind drinking, and he lost his business behind drinking, and he lost his health behind drinking. He must have been a duck. Anyway, he taught me a lot of stuff. He must have even taught me some accounting, you know. Because before I was 30 years of age, I was offered a position as the controller of a hotel and casino over in Las Vegas, Nevada. It was to be my job to go over there and finish the construction of that hotel and to be in charge of all of the financial matters of that place after it opened up. And they offered me a salary the likes of which I never believed I would ever earn. And I knew that I was on my way to becoming somebody. I knew it. You were paying attention. You know, and the little Mexican kid from Watts went over to Las Vegas, and I was somebody. That job was everything they told me that it was. It was just a tremendous job. The pay was what they said it was. The working conditions were what they said they were. Everything was just about the way they said it was. And I was on that job. Well, I was on that job until I wasn't on that job anymore. People used to ask me, if it was such a great job, Dave, why did you leave? And I'd look them right in the eye and I'd say, well, it's this way. I came to find out that some of those people were associated with the mafia. And how would it look for a rising young professional like myself to be associated with them? It would ruin my reputation, and so obviously I had to leave. Now, that's what I tell you. The surprising thing is that so many of you believed it. But this is an honest program, and I'm supposed to tell you what really happened. Well, what really happened is I was fired is what really happened, you know. You see, we had five bars in this place, and I was always down there taking inventory. And they didn't like it, and they cut me loose. And just to show you what really bad people those were that I was working for, when they cut me loose, they gave me a year's termination pay. Now, wasn't that lousy of them? Wasn't that mean of them? With this money, I decided that I could now afford to open up my own accounting practice. And I did. And those no-good rats went out and they hustled clients for me. And they made my business a success. It shows you what kind of people they were. They weren't what I was telling you at all. But more importantly, it tells you something about me. It tells you that gratitude isn't exactly my long suit, you know. And as far as I'm concerned, if you're going to ask me about me, you'd better believe I'm never going to look very bad in the telling, huh? Anyway, this business was a success, and I say, why wouldn't it be with all the help I was getting? And the business began to grow, and I began to acquire things. I had the office going there, then I got a supper club, then I got another one. And pretty soon I had to open up an office over in Beverly Hills, and it's just a doggonest thing you ever saw. It just seemed that I had, in my own mind at least, to spend time in each of those offices. And so what I'd do, my day would be just very typically getting up at 5:30 in the morning to race to McCarran Field in Las Vegas to get on a plane to fly to Los Angeles to be in the office by 8 o'clock. Stay there till noontime, then dash to the airport over in Los Angeles to get back to the office as close to 1 o'clock as I could in Las Vegas. Stay there till 5 o'clock, go home, shower, shave, throw about 4 fingers worth of whatever was handy in my gullet, you know. Then dash out to one of the supper clubs that I had. Stay there until about midnight or 1 o'clock, go home, sleep. Tomorrow, get up and do it all over again. And after a while, it just seemed like I was on the damnedest treadmill you ever saw. And I began to wonder, why are you doing this, Dave? What are you trying to prove? You know, I learned along by that time, even I had the wits to know that being a small frog in a small pond is no big deal. And it wasn't for the money. I had enough money for me. I just didn't know why I was doing it. And I was just going on and on and on. And I set my mind to the problem. In a case like mine, that almost always leads to some kind of action. It'd be pretty crazy, but I always lead to some kind of action. But I figured out what was wrong with me. I figured out that what was wrong with me was that every single thing I was doing was for Dave. I wasn't doing anything for the solitary soul in the world. And then I entered into what my friend Ungrateful Bud calls the noble period of my life. I thought I'd start doing things for other people, you know. And right about that time, I was offered a position as an instructor in accounting at the University of San Francisco. And I thought about it for a long time, something like 5 minutes, and said, yeah, that's what I'll do, you know. I'll go up to that university and be a college professor. Hot damn, huh? I don't know whether that impresses you or not, but it sure impressed me, I'll tell you, you know. The Mexican kid from Watts was now a college professor, you hot dog. And not being very impetuous, in 60 days' time, I'd sold all my business down south and I went up to be a college professor at the University of San Francisco. And now everything was going to be all right, huh? Because I was becoming somebody, wasn't I? I was really, really getting there. And I went up to the university there, and from the moment I walked in front of that classroom, I knew I'd found my niche in life. God meant for me to be a teacher. That's what he meant, you know. I just loved the classroom. I just loved it. I loved teaching. I loved everything about it. And I was very grateful to that university for having allowed me to find my niche in life. Now, this is going to surprise you. That university had been there for 100 years before I got on the scene. But they didn't know how to run it. They didn't know how to run it. They were making all kinds of mistakes, you know. And I felt indebted to them. You would too, wouldn't you? I felt indebted to them. And so what I did is I got a you know, one of these sheets of paper like this, a whole book of them, as a matter of fact, and wrote down on one side of it every single problem that they were facing, some of which they knew about and some of which they didn't have a clue about, you know. I put them all down, and then, because my mind is so ordered, on the next side I gave them a solution to each one of those problems, every one of them. And toward the end of the academic year, I asked for and received an appointment with the dean of the College of Business Administration, and I shared my wisdom with him. Now, you just know he appreciated it, right? No, he didn't fire me. He had a much simpler solution than that. He just didn't renew my contract, you know. I guess he figured, wow, what have we got here, you know? We don't need this one. And I thought, that's okay. That's okay. It doesn't really make any difference, you know. Because any dummy can teach accounting, right? I just proved that. And I figured if I was going to be a teacher, what I should do is to teach something that had real substance to it. Something that would allow me to manifest this nobility of character that was very clearly my own. And I looked around, and at that same university they had the subject matter. They were offering there a master's degree in theology. And I thought, by God, that's what I'll do. I'll get my master's degree in theology. You know, theology. The study about God and man's relationship to him. Then I could go out and tell you all about God, and God and you and God, and you and each other. You know. And so I did that. I did that. I went out and I got that degree in theology. And then I went up down the valley there a little ways, and I persuaded a Monsignor down in Salinas to allow me to open up a little institute of theology in Salinas. And God, they just loved me in Salinas, you know. I was a sensation there. I worked that whole Salinas Valley up and down the line there. And one day I came up to this Monsignor and I said, Monsignor, I have a little bit of a problem. And he says, what's your problem? And I said, well, sir, every once in a while I run across someone who wishes to speak to a priest, and I'm not a priest. What should I do about that? Well, he says, no problem, David. Get an index card, put their name, address, and phone number on it, and put it on the corner of the desk right here. We'll take care of it. That seemed fair, you know. There were six of them there and only one of me. And I figured they could take care of whatever business I brought in. And so I went on about my business. And I put one card there and two and five and 10 and 50. No kidding. That file got up about that high. And one day I went up to this Monsignor. Incidentally, you'll notice that as I go through this tale of nonsense of mine, I don't talk a whole heck of a lot about drinking. But I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll just keep going on with this insanity. Let's see if you can fit it in anywhere, okay? Anyway, I said to this Monsignor, I said, you know those cards I've got on the corner of your desk, Monsignor? He says, yeah, what about them? Well, I said, they all want to talk to a priest, and I'm not a priest. He says, well, we'll get to them, David, just as soon as we can. I said, no, you don't understand, Monsignor. I mean, they really have problems. If it was some dinky thing, I'd take care of it. But they really wish to speak to a priest. Well, he says, maybe you don't understand. I said that we were busy and we'd get to them as soon as we could. And I looked at him and I said, boy, it's clear one of us doesn't understand. It seems to me that to be a priest means that you're supposed to be of service to the people. And damn it, those people want service. And he looked at me and he said, I'd like to remind you that I've been a priest for 30 years. And I think I know what the job entails. And I looked at him in the eye and I said, well, you might have been ordained 30 years ago, but I don't think you've snapped to the idea yet. You know? So So he looked at me and he said, if you're so smart about being a priest, how come you aren't one? He had me there, didn't he? You just know what I had to do, right? I thought, by God, he's right. He's right. I can do a better job than him. And with that great thought in mind, I went down to Fresno, and I approached the Bishop of Fresno, and I asked him if he'd accept me as a candidate for the priesthood in his diocese, and he fooled me and said yes. And so at age 36, I entered the seminary to become a Roman Catholic priest. And, you know, I'd like to address a couple of remarks to the newcomers here, if I may. The rest of you can listen if you want, you know. I mean, you know, you newcomers, you know, I have no idea whether you plan on staying sober the rest of your life, a day at a time, or not. Only you know that. Lord knows I don't know if you're planning on going to seminary or not. But can I make the suggestion that if you haven't planned the former, you don't do the latter? I'm here to tell you that the seminary is no place for a practicing alcoholic, you know. Every rule they have in those places says you don't drink. You don't drink. And the first year that I was in seminary, I followed every rule they had. And I'm here to tell you that during that year, there was not even 1 minute of sobriety. I didn't drink. But what it was is teeth gritting and gut crunching dryness. It was the meanest year I've ever spent in my life. And I'm here to tell you, I wouldn't go through that year again if they promised to make me Pope at the end of it, you know. No. Well, anyway, mercifully, the year came to an end, and I came back to California, and I got well, you know. You know how I got well? I got well. And I figured, you know, that, hey, wait a minute, David. All those rules they got are for the boys that they have going to school there. And whatever I was at this stage of my life, I wasn't a boy. So for 3 more years, I ignored their rules, and they ignored me. At age 40, I was ordained a priest to Roman Catholic Church, and now everything was going to be all right, huh? Now I was becoming somebody. I was going to be all right. And the bishop said to me that I should go to a little town out in the San Joaquin Valley, a place called Porterville. And he said the people were so friendly and nice and cooperative in Porterville. And I thought, God, that's neat. I'd never met kind and cooperative people anywhere. I didn't know they had them hoarded in Porterville, you know. So I went to Porterville to serve all those nice people over there. And I got to Porterville, and on my way down there, I determined that what I was going to do is to just serve God's people. By God, and I was going to find those that were in the greatest need and serve them. And I found them the first day I got there. I found them the first day. I just drove into town and I found the neediest people God ever had. They were the farm workers. They had the worst jobs. They had the worst pay. They had the worst housing. They had the worst period. And I determined that, by God, I was going to spend the rest of my life working with farm workers. You may remember that right about that time there was a farm workers union getting started. And they just called a strike in the grape fields, you know. And so I picked up my picket sign and started marching around grape fields with them. And I used to preach brilliant and eloquent sermons on the justice of the farm worker cause and the injustice of the growers and the ranchers and all those bad old oppressors, you know. Now, I don't know if there's any labor organizers here tonight, but if there are, let me tell you, the book of the prophet Jeremiah, better still Amos, from the book of the Old Testament of the Bible, that's our book. So I preached brilliantly from the book of the prophet Amos. And they wouldn't listen to Amos, I'd preach them from Jeremiah. And they wouldn't listen to either one of those guys, I'd level them with Moses and just get on with it, you know. Anyway, I was being brilliant and eloquent in this fashion here for about a year. And one day, the pastor of this place says, David, I'd like to have a little talk with you. And I said, sure, Joe, what about? He says, the way you're preaching. I said, what about the way I'm preaching? He says, the things you're saying. I said, Joe, I didn't write those books. I just preach from them. He says, yes, David, but you've got to learn to be a little more suave. And I said, suave my... Well, I'm not going to tell you what I said. I said, my suavity isn't your problem. I said, what's your problem? He says, okay, I'll tell you the problem. The problem is that when you got here, our collection was $1,200 every Sunday. And I said, what's wrong with that? He said, nothing. is with that kind of money we could run that school across the street, pay off some of the debt on the church, fix things up a little bit, and even have a couple of dollars left over. And I said, so? He said, well, since you've been so brilliant and so eloquent, you've managed to get it from $1,200 a Sunday to $600 a Sunday, and it's heading south. You see, the people that were supporting this church were all growers and ranchers and all those bad old oppressors. And so I looked at Joe and I said, hey, Joe, if they don't want to support this place, we'll just close the damn church. I'm here to tell you we didn't close the damn church. What happened is I was transferred. I was transferred to another little town in the valley there, a place called Corcoran. A year and a half later, I'm standing in front of the bishop, and he's waving his finger at me and saying, young man, you got to tone it down. And I'm saying, I can't, bishop. And he says, why not? And I said, because I'm right. And when you're right, you're right. Didn't impress him. Didn't impress him at all. He says, you will tone it down. I'm saying, but I can't. And he says, you will. And I says, I won't. He said, you will. He says, I won't. I've got a solution for you, bishop. He says, what's your solution? I said, well, sir, I said, the farm workers want me to go to work with them full time. I wish to go to work with them full time. The people in Corcoran want me to go almost anywhere full time, you know? So why don't you let me do it and everything would be all right? Well, he did transfer me. He wouldn't let me go to work with the farm workers. What he did is he transferred me to be a chaplain at the state prison up in Tehachapi. I guess he figured, what harm can this dummy do up there? If they didn't like what I was preaching, what were they going to do about it? But it didn't work out that way. It didn't at all. From the moment I set foot inside that joint, I knew those were my people. It wasn't until I sobered up in AA that I knew why they were my people, but they were my people, you know. And I jumped into prison work just like I do everything else, right up to here, you know. And in 6 months' time, I knew that the state of California didn't know the first thing about running a prison system. God, they were blowing it just everywhere, you know. And I used to just corner anybody that I could and tell them about it. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking most people disagreed with me, right? Well, you're wrong. Most people agreed with what I was saying. And it wasn't until I sobered up that I figured that out. Those that were agreeing with me all had on blue denims. Anyway, one day I'm hitting on to the superintendent of this place and telling him why his system is just simply never going to work. And apropos of nothing at all, he says to me, say, Father Dave, didn't you tell me you'd like to go to work full-time with the farm workers? And I said to him, yes, I would, and I've asked the bishop for that permission, but he won't grant it to me. And he looked at me and says, I make you bet that if you ask him one more time, he will. You know, by now I learned a very important lesson. Being a Catholic priest is a good job. You don't hardly ever get fired. You get moved around a whole lot, but you... So I went down and I asked the bishop for this permission, and he said yes. And now everything's going to be all right, wasn't it? God, I went to work with the farm workers and I just jumped into it like I do everything else, right up to here again. And you know, I've picketed every grape field in California, from the Mexican border clear on up to Stockton and around Sacramento. You know, round and around those fields, we'd picket and we'd picket and we'd picket. And we'd come to a Safeway store and we'd go around them four or five times just to boycott them a little bit, you know. And we picketed and we boycotted and we picketed some more and boycotted some more. And by God, we won that strike, you know. We won that grape strike. And then just to show the world that we weren't prejudiced, you know what we did? We went over to Salinas and hopped in lettuce fields and went round and round lettuce fields for a while, you know. Over in Salinas is where they changed my name. Yeah, they did. They changed it from Father David to that goddamn priest, you know. they love me in Salinas, I'll tell you, you know. Anyway, I was full-time with the Farm Workers Union for about 3.5 years when it suddenly dawned on me that, you know what, those people didn't know how to run a Farm Workers Union. They didn't really know what was best for farm workers. I knew, and they wouldn't listen. Came time to move on. So I moved on to went to the bishop and I asked him if he would let me go to a little parish in a little town called Visalia, little Mexican parish there, and I told him I had all kinds of friends who were going to come and help me, and they'd come from all over the country, and he said, okay, go ahead and do it. And that's about as much enthusiasm as he showed, too. And I went there, and as far as I know, that plan that I laid out before the bishop worked just the way I told him. The people did come to give me a hand, and that thing did work, and everything was going fine, but by this time there was one member of this whole shebang that wasn't functioning too good. And of course that was me. By now I didn't know what to do. I became frightened of people. I remember I had either become famous or infamous, depending upon your own point of view, and would beat the drum and create the propaganda and tell the people that come on out and hear the fiery Father David do his number. And the day would come, the event would fill ballparks. And the day would come. The problem was the fiery Father David didn't feel like doing his number, you know. And I'll never forget this poor guy that worked with me, a guy named Ed, Father Ed. Ed would come by and say, okay, Dave, they're all over there. Let's get going. And I say, I can't go, Ed. He says, what do you mean you can't go? Well, I just can't go. He says, why not? I says, I can't. I'm afraid of them. He says, David, they love you over there. Come on. I said, no, I can't. And he'd say, why? And I'd look at him and give him the best answer I had. I'd say, because, that's why. Have you ever tried to explain to a normie why you can't do what you can't do? They're never going to understand. And finally, I'd say, okay, Ed, okay. Give me a couple of minutes. A couple of these, filled with the good giggly, and I'd go out and be my fiery Father David self for you, you know. I'd stand in front of microphones, and I'd go to podiums, and I'd get on all, I'd do all of those things. And I'd be just as bright and shiny as you want me to be. And when I was through, I'd walk out among you and I'd slap you on the back and I'd smile at all of you and I'd look for the exit sign so I could escape one more time. And I'd just escape from you and I'd go back to my quarters and I'd go in there and I'd lock the door. And nobody, but nobody could get in there. And the doorbell would ring and I wouldn't answer and the phone would ring and ring and ring and ring. And I couldn't answer the damn thing. And I didn't know what was the matter. But I finally got so screwy that even I recognized it. And you know, when you can recognize your own screwiness, you're screwy. And so I went up to the bishop and I asked him if he would give me a year's leave of absence to try to straighten myself out. And he said he would. And so I got ready to go. And I mentioned it to this friend of mine. And Johnny says, where are you going? I said, you don't understand, John, I'm just going. When you're going, you don't have to have a direction. You just have to go. And I'm going. Up, down, east, west, north, south. Doesn't make any difference. I'm just going. He says, well, have you any money? And I said, of course I have no money. What's that got to do with it? It's just time to go. And he felt sorry for me. And so he said, look, I've got this home down in Laguna Niguel in California, just south of Laguna Beach there. It's a big house. I'm there by myself. You're welcome to come and stay with me for as long as you like. And that's how I wound up down in Southern California. It could have been anywhere else. You know, I don't know what anybody else's limit is as far as drinking is concerned, but let me tell you my own. I can tell you that after 30 years of drinking, the last 10 or 15 of them on a daily basis, I'm not at all sure of that, I can tell you that it's only possible for me to stay drunk from the first day of July of 1972 until January the 23rd of 1973. During that 7-month period, it was just round-the-clock drinking. There was not one day that could be remotely called a sober day. It was just round-the-clock drinking. Well, you know what I was like at the end of that period. My stomach was in such a knot that I couldn't even breathe. I couldn't breathe, and I'd have to have one or two, wouldn't I? Just to prime the pump, for God's sake. And I had a 90-mile-an-hour head. Oh, God, it wouldn't stop. It wouldn't stop, and it would go and go and go and go and go and go, and I was a walker and a pacer and a mover about. And no part of me could ever be still for very long. And I was just, my head was just going and going and going. And I didn't know how to turn it off. And I didn't know how to turn it off. And I didn't know what the matter was. I didn't know. I remember that I'd lie down and say, my God, would lie on the couch there and say, if you're for real and if you're a merciful God, would you please just turn it off? Just turn it off. I'm tired. Oh, I know. I'm supposed to serve your people, but I don't know how to serve them. I don't have anything they want. And if I had it, I don't know how I'd give it to them. Please just turn it off. But he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't do it. And, you know, by this time I'd lost the ability to sleep. I couldn't sleep. You know why I couldn't sleep? Because every time, I don't mean once in a while, I mean every single time I'd lie down and close my eyes, those things would start to crawl from underneath the bed and out of the corners, and they'd come over and they'd try to get me. And I couldn't let them get me, could I? Huh? So I'd have to open up my eyes, and finally I took to sleeping with a bat by the side of the bed. And I'd have to hold one eye open just to be sure that I could see them. You don't get a lot of sleep that way. But I'd keep drinking, you know, and I found out something. I found out that if you put enough booze inside yourself, by God, you're going to experience that blessed passing out time. And God, that was wonderful, you know, because then everything stopped. My head stopped. My belly quit hurting. Everything stopped. And God, that was wonderful. But there's one thing wrong with passing out time, isn't there? Sooner or later, you're going to have to come to. It's coming to time. Then you got to get up, and you got to do it all over again. And there's no way of predicting whether you're passing out time. Is it 2 in the morning or 2 in the afternoon? And I didn't know what to do. Well, during this 7-month period, this guy that had taken me in was going drink for drink with me. And at the end of 7 months, he was just as crazy as me, you know. And he was always talking about retiring. And I said to him, Johnny, quit talking about retiring. You're not going to get a chance to retire. He says, why not? I said, you're not going to get a chance to retire, John, because they're going to fire you. He says, after all these years with the company, why would they do that? And I looked at him and I said, well, the fact you haven't been to work for 3 months may have something to do with it. He looked at me and he said, what do you think the matter is? And I says, hell, I know what's the matter with you, John. He says, what's the matter with me? I said, you drink too much. He looked at me and said, what do you think we ought to do about it? Well, I knew exactly what to do for John. I knew exactly what to do for John. You see, when I'd been a prison chaplain up there, I used to watch you people from the H&I committees come on up and save those people up there, right? One of those guys is right there. And I used to watch you all come up and save those prisoners, and I knew if I called you, you'd come up and save John, too. So I called Central Office in Orange County, California, for them to come save John. And whoever answered the telephone there gave me a number in Laguna Beach. And so I called that number in Laguna Beach for those folks to come save John. And whoever answered that telephone said, we've got a meeting going on at this place right now. Do you think you can get your sick friend down here? Now, you know, that's got to be the dumbest question in the world to ask a drunk with keys to the car. Could I get him down there? We're living in Laguna Beach. There's a 4-lane highway into Laguna. And I had a nice car. Of course I could get him down there. I don't remember the ride. John says it was a hell of a ride, you know. Anyway, we got him to that meeting there, and they were reading out of a book, a blue one. And they read some, and they talked some. And they read some more, and they talked some more. Read some more, talked some more, read some more, talked some more. Did some more reading, some more talking. And then the meeting came to an end. Well, as any self-respecting newcomer would, I was seated at the back of the room, listening, you know. And I'm just looking there. And after the meeting came to an end, this guy got up and he walked right to me. And he said, you must be the fellow that called. And I said, I am, but how did you know? And then I said, look at my sick friend John. And I told him all about John. I told him how John had taken me in, what a wonderful man he was. I told him that John had been with this company for 30 years, and he was old enough, almost old enough to retire, and I told him that he hadn't been to work for 3 months, and I don't know what I didn't tell him about John. And the guy just stood there, he's looking at me, just standing there looking at me, And he listened, 20 minutes, nonstop. And 20 minutes into this tirade, he looked at me and he says, do you mind if I ask you a question? And I said, no, it seems fair. He says, don't you think maybe you have a problem too? Now, he shouldn't have done that. You see, that was the one question that I would allow no one to ask, and that dummy went ahead and did it. And to this day, I don't know why I answered him as I did. I looked at him and I said, yeah, I guess I do. And at that instant, I knew my life was over. I knew that I was through. Any hopes that were mine, any dreams, any aspirations, any plans that I had, had just been shattered. Because what in God's name is an alcoholic priest good for anyhow? Of what possible use could he be to anybody? I knew that I was through. I knew that I was finished. And I didn't care. I hurt so bad, I didn't know what to do. And that man told me that I should go home and try to get to a meeting at that club the next day at noontime. A place called the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach. I said, well, I don't know that I can do that. I've never done that. Number one, I'm sure I can't go to sleep. And number two, I'm sure that I cannot get to noontime without drinking. He says, well, try it. And so I went home. And for the first night in many, many months, I fell asleep. And those things didn't come after me. But I woke up at the same time I always do when I have nothing to do. 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm wide awake. And I thought, oh my God, that man said I shouldn't have a drink. What'll I do? And I know what I'll do. I'll make a pot of coffee. And so I made a pot of coffee and drank it right down. Then I made another pot of coffee. Then I took a long cold shower. And I went for a long walk. Then I came back and I made another pot of coffee. Then I took another shower. And I went for another long walk. And I came back and I made another pot of coffee. And I took another shower. And I went for another long walk. And now it's 7 o'clock. I'm never going to make it. I'm just not going to make it, you know. I like to remember that day because I fought booze from the moment I woke up that morning until the time that I got to that meeting. I'm personally convinced that if the meeting had been at 12:15, you'd never have seen me. Because by noontime, I was all tuckered out. And I got to that meeting, and there was a lady leading that meeting, and the most beautiful woman I've ever laid eyes on in my life. And she was talking about trust and hope and what it meant in the context of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, oh my, if I could just get a sliver of what that lady's talking about, I'll settle for that. And then she said something. She said to me, she says, you know, Dave, you don't ever have to have a drink again as long as you live if you don't want to. And I says, you don't understand. I haven't wanted to for a long time. That doesn't seem to have anything to do with it. And she says, yes, but you don't ever have to drink again as long. That's my problem. You've just put your finger on my problem. I don't know how to not drink. And she said, once again, you don't ever have to. And I said, oh, hell. She said, how would you go about not drinking? She says, well, why don't you give your problem to somebody that can handle it? And I says, gladly, who? Well, she says, didn't you tell me that you were a priest? And I says, yeah. I says, you mean to God? And she said, yeah. And I said, hell, that's my line, you know. It doesn't work, lady. She says, try it. And I went home from that meeting thinking, well, this isn't going to work either. And I was disappointed because for a little instant there, I had a glimmer of hope. And I went home and we had a deck and I walked up and down that deck there for, oh, golly, I don't know how many hours. But finally it dawned on me that, you know, what the hell did I have to lose? And I was through and I was finished. It didn't make any difference. And so I was looking out over the ocean and I said, hey, God, you know, that lady said that you could handle this problem. Well, maybe you can. I don't know. I can't believe that you will. But I'll tell you what. If I'm supposed to be a drunk and die a drunk, I guess I shall just have to die a drunk. For my part, I'm going to do what I can. They told me to come to a meeting over there, and I'm going to go to that meeting over there. Why that should make a difference, I'll be damned if I know, but I'm going to try it. Now, you know, that was January 23rd, 1973. And from that day to this one, I haven't had a drink. Now, you know, I have no way of explaining that. Because up to the minute I got to you, I wanted to drink. From the minute I got to you to this one, I have not. Now, I don't know what you call things like that, but things that I cannot explain, I call miracles. And you know, I determined to do whatever it was you people told me to do. Not because I'm so self-sacrificing and grand, but because I had nothing better to do. And I had nowhere else to go. I was through and I knew it. And I start doing everything. Do you want to know what the first thing was I heard you people tell me? You know what it was? Come on in, Dave. You're home now. Come on in, Dave. You're home now. We don't care where you've been. It doesn't make any difference to us what you've done. Come on in, Dave. You're home now. And God, that was good, you know. I'd finally come somewhere where people didn't care that I become something else. And you told me something that I didn't know. You told me that I had a disease, and that the disease was called alcoholism. And you told me it was of a twofold nature. You told me that my body was allergic to booze, and that when I put booze in my system, it reacted differently than other people's. Well, my God, that's certainly true. And then you said, yes, but that isn't the end of it, David. You also suffer from an obsession that is of such a nature that if you even take one drink, you're not going to be able to predict with any degree of certitude what might happen after that. I thought, yeah, that's the way it happens, all right. And you know, it was good to know that I had a disease. I was pleased to find that out. Because prior to that time, I had considered myself a total ingrate and therefore very bad. I told you of some of the gifts that God has given to me, and you know as well as I do that these are things that some people die for, but no, not Dave. I could throw them out the window one at a time. I knew I was dishonest and ungrateful and therefore bad, and you looked at me and said, no, David, you're not a bad man trying to get good. For heaven's sake, what you are is a sick one trying to get well. And that felt good to know, too. That felt awfully good to know. And I began to do just everything you told me to do. Well, one of the things that you told me to do was to go to that roundup in Palm Springs, California. And I don't like Palm Springs, California. Reminds me too much of Gallup, New Mexico. But you told me that I had to go. And I went. And I got down there, and just as I knew there were too many people there, they scared me to death. And it was dusty, and the wind was blowing, and it was miserable. And I'll be forever indebted to you. Because of a Sunday morning, there was an old man whom I'd never laid eyes on before that morning, and has since become my dearest friend. And he was talking on a Sunday morning, and here's what I heard him say. He said, if you're looking for God up there somewhere, you shall never find him, because he's not up there. In order to find him, you have to find him where he is. And he's right in here. Now, as a Catholic priest, how many times do you suppose I've said the same thing myself? But for whatever reason, the God that is allowed it to drop from up here, where it was only information, down to about 2 inches back of my belly button, where I knew that he's right in here. In the middle of 5,000 people, I just sat there and cried like a baby. Because isn't that something? Here I am, a man who purports to serve God, and I have to come amongst a bunch of drunks to be introduced to him. Because there's a big difference, isn't there, between knowing about God and knowing him. And you people introduced me to him. And I owe you. And I owe you. And down where I was going to meetings, you know, they kept telling the newcomers that if you don't pray, you're going to get drunk. They weren't even trying to spare our feelings. They just said, if you don't pray, you're going to get drunk. I went up to this friend of mine, and I said, Frank, I don't know what to do. And he said, what's your problem? I said, well, you keep saying that if I don't pray, I'm going to get drunk. He says, that's the truth. What's your problem? I said, well, sir, you might find this hard to believe of a Catholic priest, but I don't know how to pray anymore. If I get on my knees, my mind goes wherever my mind goes. It just takes off. And if I go into a church or a chapel, I fall asleep. And I don't know what to do. Because you tell me that if I don't pray, I'm going to get drunk. And if I get drunk, I'm going to die. And I don't wish to die, not that way. And he says, let me ask you a couple of things, David. And I said, sure. He said, do you really believe God's in here like you say? And I said, I do. Then he asked me, do you believe he's within me? And I said, of course he is. And then he asked me, do you believe he's within each and every member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I thought for a minute and I said, yeah. Yeah, sure he is, yeah. He said, okay, Dave, as sick as you are, your prayer had better be talking to another alcoholic on a daily basis. And I thought about that for a minute, you know. And I thought, by God, that's right. If God is there, and I know he is, whether you know it or not, I know he is, and if I tell you how it really is with me, you know, from 2 inches back of my belly button, if I tell you about my joys, and if I tell you about my fears, if I tell you about my frustration, and if I tell you about my plans, if I just tell you about me, by God, he's going to hear it, and not as an eavesdropper either, but as a party to the conversation. And I have no idea whether that sounds like prayer to you or not. But I'm here to tell you that for over 2 years, that was the only prayer of which I was capable. And so I went to a meeting every day, and I wouldn't miss a chance for the world. I'm happy to report that today my father and I have long conversations, but I figure this to be bonus. And the God that I've come to know, he speaks to me too, you know. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, no. No voices out of clouds and no big winds. None of that stuff. But the things that I have to hear, he puts them in your mouth. And you tell them to me. And then he unplugs my ears so that I can hear them. My sponsor says that I have become teachable. And he defines being teachable as being willing to learn from the experience of others. Isn't that neat? You know, my becoming teachable is a miracle. Because you see, if you're as overeducated and underinformed as I am, learning is very difficult. But even I have become teachable. Anyway, you told me that I had to work those steps, the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did. And again, I'm indebted to you. As a result of working those steps, I learned an awful lot about myself. I can tell you this with no sense of egocentricity at all, but I've got a new love affair in my life. I've fallen in love with Dave. I'm just tickled to death to be me. I don't want to be anybody else. I don't want to be anywhere else, and I want to be in the company of anybody but you. You've made it possible for me to be me and to love myself warts and all, you know. I just think being Dave is a neat thing. And as the result of learning to love myself warts and all, I learned that learning to love you and your warts was a cinch too, you know. See, there's another bonus. I had always been able to talk to you, plural, but I'd never been able to talk to you as an individual. And as a result of working the steps of this program and being close to the fellowship, I can tell you that your sobriety and your health is important to me. I can tell you that you are important in my life. I can look in your eyes and say, you're a great guy, and I love you. And I think you're a beautiful lady, and I love you too. And I can do those things. I could never do it before. Never, ever do it before. As a result of sobriety, I went back up to my bishop and I told him what you people had done for me. I told him that you'd sobered me up. And I told him that you allowed me to go to meetings. And I told him that you allowed me to make 12-step calls. And there was a guy from up your neck of the woods up here named Barney. Father Barney. And Barney picked me up down below there. And he had me trailing around with him doing those retreats. And I told him that you allowed me to do those things too. And he said, well, what do you want now, David? And I said, no, you don't understand, Bishop. I don't do that anymore. I don't tell people what I want anymore. Down where I go to meetings, they tell me that I'm supposed to look to other people for guidance and direction. He said, well, what do you want from me? I said, guidance and direction. He says, well, where do you want to go? And I says, it's up to you, Bishop, wherever you want to. He says, okay, I'll tell you. And I thought, now you've tied it, David. It's the Mojave Desert for sure, you know. And he said, what I want you to do is to go back down where you are, Dave, and continue doing what you're doing. Stay close to your alcoholic friends, and you stay close to that retreat work that Barney has showed you how to do, and you stay close to those things. And I busted out laughing. And he says, what are you laughing at now? And I said, Bishop, you just assigned me to be a full-time member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, yeah, what's funny about that? And I says, I guess I'm the only guy in the world that has as a full-time job staying alive. Because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is to me. You know, I owe everything and everything that I've ever learned to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, bar nothing. As a result of this program, you've introduced me to me. As a result of this program, you've introduced me to you. As a result of this program, you've returned me to a profession that I dearly love. Oh, don't get me wrong, please. Being a priest is only a job. But hey, it's my job. And it's a job that I personally am absolutely convinced my father would have me do. It's a good job. It's a necessary job. And it's my job, and I owe it to you. Every single thing about this program. I've been privileged to travel all over the world with Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is a privilege. And you've taught me how to live. And you know this guy, John, that I was telling you about? He never did sober up in our program. And God, did I have to thank the Al-Anons for teaching me how to live with that. And I've got an Al-Anon sponsor that I've had from damn near the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And John never really made our program, but boy, he did more 12-step work than any of us. I'd get calls from all over, and he'd answer them. And I'd say to him, Johnny, what'd you tell him? He says, same stuff you tell him. Easy does it, one day at a time, keep coming back. Anyway, Johnny and I'd been living at his house now about 6 years when the doctor advised him that he had cancer of the lungs and the bone, and he got very ill, and he tried chemotherapy, and he tried all that stuff, and it didn't work for him. And it became evident that he was going to die. And he asked me, he said, you know, David, I don't wish to die in a hospital. Can I die at home? And I said, well, of course you can die at home if that's what's supposed to be. And so I brought him home. And I went out wondering, how the heck do we do this? And I hired somebody to come look after him, and that didn't work out. After a couple of weeks, it was clear that wasn't going to work out. And a friend of mine was over visiting, another priest on the program. And I said, Frank, let me tell you, I've got a problem I don't know what the heck to do about. John is here, and I've got to teach over at the university, and I've got these retreats that I've got scheduled, and I've got all this work that I got to do, and somebody's got to stay with him. You just can't leave him alone. What am I going to do? And Frank says, well, have you asked your friends to help you? And I said, you don't understand, Frank. They all work. You know, they've got jobs, and they work. He said, David, you know, you are undoubtedly the most arrogant son of a bitch I've ever met in my life. He said, you run around North America telling people to love each other. You run those retreats of yours and you tell us that we're supposed to care for each other. And now it's your turn. And you're too damned arrogant to ask for help. And he ripped my hide off one side and down the other, and I didn't know what to do except sit there and listen. And then he left. And it was about 10 o'clock at night. And it was a Sunday night. And I needed somebody to take care of John tomorrow morning. And I picked up the phone and I said, hey, Bill, could you come be with John tomorrow? He says, great. What time do you want me there? And he showed up at 6 o'clock the next morning and he stayed there till 10 at night. And I called somebody else for Tuesday and somebody else for Wednesday and somebody else for Thursday and so on. And for 8 months, at our house, we had the damnedest AA meeting you ever saw. It was just around the clock AA. And they were never too busy. And they were never too tired. And they always showed up. And once again, you taught me that, David, God damn it, David, you've got to walk like you talk. You've got to do what you ask other people to do. And you've got to be just as weak as you can possibly be so that people can make you strong. So look at that. I come amongst you an absolute and a total loser. I was through, I was finished, and there was no part of me that was going to be any better. You've given me back my life. You've introduced me to God, and the God that I know and love and serve today. You've returned me to a job that I dearly love. And you've taught me how to live. How will I ever be able to repay you? Somebody says to me one time, the way you do that, Dave, is by walking the way you talk. And I decided that's not good enough. That's not good enough. I don't want to walk the way I talk. I want to walk the way I hear you talk. And that's the way to do it. I love AA, and I love being sober. One last comment, then I will shut up. I was down, there's a neighborhood down in Los Angeles that's very spiffy, a place called San Marino. God, they're real spiffy. And one day I was invited to give a pitch down there, and so I got real pretty for those ladies and gentlemen, just like I did for you tonight, you know. I went down there, and after I'd got through with this talk, this lady came up to me. She said, "Are you really a priest?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am." She says, "You celebrate Mass and hear confessions and all that stuff?" I said, "Yeah, all that stuff." She said, "Really?" And I said, "Well, yeah, really." "Well," she says, "look at you. You don't look like a priest, you know." I looked at her and I said, "You know, lady, you're right. But you should have seen me when I did." You'll just have to take my word for it. This is a better version. I want to share one thing more and then I will sit down. When I left the Diocese of Fresno 11 years ago, it was so long, goodbye, and God bless you. As a result of sobriety and as a result of getting my act together, just about 6 months ago, my bishop gave me an honor and a responsibility. He made me what we call in our place his vicar, and put me in charge of all of the property and the finances and the money of the diocese. That's a hell of a thing for a drunk, isn't it? Huh? And when he did that, I told him that I wanted him to be certain that he knew that it was to you people, because see, he knows all about my alcoholism, and he's the greatest supporter of Alcoholics Anonymous that you'll ever find. And he said to me one time, "If you ever get a chance to, David, thank those people." So I end the night. God bless.